Hello, good people. Shay Good Guy with another mini session. Making up for lost time, being Black on Earth, the podcast. As I promised that I would hit you guys up with another mini, so before I actually release a full episode in the next 10 days. So I bet you can probably guess what I want to talk about today because it's trending. I mean, it's being Black on Earth. I'll give you three guesses, but I bet you'll get it in one. Critical race theory. What is it? I live in Florida, where the GOP governor and hobbit, Ron DeSantis, has banned it. So I can't tell you. I'm not allowed to teach it. No. He doesn't want it taught to kids. He doesn't want kids to learn about racism. Or I guess maybe he wants kids to learn about racism the old-fashioned way in school, but certainly not from a textbook, because apparently, like Black men, Black history is also violent and scary. I find it ironic that they're making, if you listen to what all the detractors are saying, and there are some big names out there that are, all of them, big names and little ones, names I can't pronounce, people I've never heard of, all the way up to all the political pundits and politicians that are calling it communism. Critical race theory is communist theory. It comes from the Frankfurt School. And that's interesting that the importing of communist ideas makes pink toes curl. Because communist. Well, isn't it interesting that communist China actually imports about $500 billion in goods to the U.S. And it has been doing that for about a decade. And the U.S. is actually the CHICOM's largest trading partner. Like, they are number one for China. About 20% of all U.S. imports come from the CCP. So I guess we should say, go communism? Wait, because we hate communism. Or is there a difference? Is it just Marxism that we hate? Or is it just Marxist ideology that we hate? I think we hate the ideas, but we love the bedsheets and the ties and the machinery. I don't know. So critical race theory. We should talk about it, right? I need to talk about it because it's trending, it's politics, and this is my podcast. I would be remiss if I left you guys hanging on what critical race theory is. First of all, critical race theory. They use the acronym CRT, and they also have a diminutive version where they just call it CRIT. I think that actually came from Kimberly Crenshaw. They call it CRIT for short. Critical race theory is not being taught in public school. How do I know? Very simple, because it would be like teaching tort law to third graders, all right? It would be like teaching tort law to third graders. Even lawyers don't know what tort law is. Critical race theory is a university topic. It's studied by law students. In order for anyone to really properly study it, you'd have to be well-read on a number of subjects, including constitutional law, economics, sociology, psychology, philosophy, history. That's world history and U.S. history. And that does include African-American history, to coin a term. No, I didn't make that up. African-American history, in case you didn't know, the blacks do have a history. It's a thing, and it's awesome. Now, critical race theory is not diversity and inclusion training. You can't see me right now because I'm invisible, but I'm behind your back making air quotes to signify that critical race theory is not a training. In other words, for example, your developmental reading teacher does not have the time, the mental emotional bandwidth, and probably not the inclination to go through all that it takes to learn the practice of critical race theory. And it cannot be taught in a Zoom workshop for credit hours. Okay? So that's why I'm hoping that people will just cut the bullshit. Whatever critical race theory is, you don't need to worry about it. It's sort of like a Grammy-winning white female rapper. You have never seen one. It is not being taught in your public school, and little Timmy is not being indoctrinated at daycare. I can assure you. Critical race theory is the practice of interrogating the role of race and racism in the society. It emerged in the legal academy and spread to other fields of scholarship. See, I know you like the way I worded that, and that's because I stayed up all night, and then just now I Googled it. Now, there's people out there, the ones I've mentioned before, that are out there throwing these words like postmodernism, Marxist ideology, the Frankfurt School. Because these are a bunch of sadists. And they're throwing these big words at you to hurt you. They're hoping that they leave bruises and welts that spell out commie. The commie, the great American villain. McCarthy era MacGuffin. And they were the bad guys in like every single 80s action movie when I was growing up. All of them, and I mean them with a capital V, and Jordan Peterson, all lowercase, they want you to know that the commies murdered, and they murdered a lot. Okay? And these murders, they weren't the result of a bunch of greedy, power-hungry megalomaniacs that the ones that we're used to seeing committing all these murders. No, this time, it's the ideology. It's the communist, the Marxist ideology. You could take a regular person, just a regular guy, put some Marxist ideology, cram it into his brain, and then he becomes a murderous comic book villain who also wants to provide you with good education and free healthcare. Apparently, allegedly, according to the Black Book of Communism. Let's see who that was written by. The Book of Communism. Jean-Louis Panet, Andrzej Paczkowski, Karel Bartosek, Jean-Louis Margolin, Nicholas Wirth, Stéphane Courtois. According to that, communism has killed 100 million people, all of communism, throughout all the time that communism has existed, which is about 100 years now. The first communist country on forward. 100 million people. That's a lot of people. It's way more than COVID, but probably less than the bubonic plague. However, it's about as much as capitalism. The only difference, I guess, is that communism just would shoot you in the back of the head and probably, I guess, starve you to death with a bunch of like mass famines. With capitalism, they just invade your country, work you to death, maim you, and then pull your bodies into mass graves. That's the old capitalism, though. Let's not go back that far. The modern capitalism will work you to the bone, stuff you full of dollar menu cheeseburgers, and then watch you die for lack of affordable healthcare. I only mention that because did you know that communist countries actually lead the world in health outcomes, life expectancies, literacy, and women's education? They just don't tell you that in the Black Book of Communism. Now, hold on, because I'm going to toss a morbid fact at you. African Americans. See, doesn't that make you sad? It makes me sad. It's two general ideas with no specifics. What I'm about to say is indubitably going to make you sad. At least it should. It makes me sad. African Americans, despite living in a first world country, good old US of A, actually have a lower expectancy of achieving maturity than many people of third world countries. And that includes China and parts of India, the two largest populations in the world. And Black Americans don't just die young. They don't even reach adulthood. The one time that we're actually early for something, and it's death. Enough about communism. Let's get back to critical race theory. Critical race theory has about as much to do with communism today as a tuna casserole has to do with a Black family reunion. I mean, you can bring your tuna casserole, but you have to take it with you when you leave. See, because Black people, we're not as frightened by communism as white people appear to be. The reasons for that are maybe they're complicated. Maybe they're too lengthy for just this measly episode and certainly this podcast. I think I can just sum it up in one word. White people. Okay, because Europeans have been kicking African ass for 500 years. That's five times as old as any communist country or communist idea. And white people right here in the U.S., they put black folks in the gulag for about 100 years before any communist country existed. They just called it a plantation. Plantation sounds better than gulag, but I guarantee you it's the same goddamn thing. In gulags, they would house political prisoners and criminals. Plantations were run by politicians and criminals. That's the difference. Back to critical race theory. Derrick Bell, the first black man to ever become a tenured law professor at Howard University. This is back in the 70s. He developed critical race theory along with some other scholars, activists, legal scholars, and this was over like a period of time because he observed monumental civil rights acts being eroded and undermined, like the Fair Housing Act of 1968. And he watched how there was so much apathy in punishing violations of the Fair Housing Act and separate but equal. He saw how these things were being undermined. Even at the state level legislature, they would do things to counteract. Okay, so Bell, you should know, he had a reputation. He was kind of a wild man because he had like these radical ideas. Like he thought that more black women and minorities should be tenured professors at major universities. And he would also like provide lunch for his students. Like he would have them have refreshments. It's pretty weird. And instead of like lecturing them and talking at them, he would actually have conversations with them and go through scenarios with them. He was just radical. So radical, in fact, that when Barack Obama first became president, all the conservatives, the Bill O'Reillys, the Sean Hannitys, going crazy. Because apparently Barack Obama once spoke to Derrick Bell. Yikes. And it's worse. It gets worse. They actually show a video. I think it's on the Bill O'Reilly show. In 1990, they're having some kind of rally or something at Harvard. And former two-time president Barack Obama introduced Bell as a guest speaker. And when Bell approached the stage, the husband of America's first black first lady hugged Professor Bell. Yeah, exactly. This is some crazy. This is radical shit. Now, I have to be real with y'all. Derrick Bell, he didn't trust Whitey. But wait, no. I guess that's not radical. Yeah, he was practical because he didn't really trust white people. And he was really vocal about it. And he had some theories on this. He actually had one that he observed over time that he called interest convergence. Or another word that he would use, term that he would use for it was material determinism. So those are just like really big terms, right? You have to try to put them together and make sense of them. But most of us kind of like make that face with a look. Like when we sense interest convergence, it's just like a knowing, like a look that we make. And I'll give you an example. If you have kids, you ever have your little kid come up to you and like, "Hey, Dad, want something from the refrigerator? You want like a beer or a soda?" And you're like, "Oh my God, how sweet. You want to get me something from the refrigerator?" He's like, "Yeah, it's okay if I go to the refrigerator." You're just like, that face that you make right there, like, what is going on here? What does this kid want? And then you find out that it's really that they want something from the refrigerator, but their mother has already told them for the third time to stay the hell out of the refrigerator. That look on your face, it's that look like if you've got an ex-wife and you got kids with her and she calls you like 3 days in a row just to say hi and check up on you. That face right there, that's when you realize interest convergence is afoot. And that's the face that Derrick Bell had on all the time. Every time he was in the presence of well-meaning white people. It basically describes the tendency of someone to do something nice, something good, but not because it's the right thing to do, but because they get something out of it. And so it's a win-win for them. You think they're being nice to you, but really they're getting something on the back end. That's material determinism, basically broke down So Bell deduced that this is the reason that the civil rights was suddenly shuttled along so quickly, because most people don't know that the civil rights movement started around 1948, but it didn't even get noticed until around 1962. That's when white people started getting involved. And next thing you know, by 1964, we're having the very first drafts of civil rights acts and bills being passed through Congress. And Bell was a little bit skeptical of that. He started to wonder, like, how is it that we go 12 years without being noticed? And then all of a sudden, you notice us 12, 14 years, however long it was. And then suddenly we're being noticed. Well, he surmised that what was actually happening at the time was communism. America at that time, don't forget, they were about to start fighting the commies in Vietnam. It's sort of the issue that Israel is having right now with Palestine, where it's kind of hard to feel bad for a country that has massive amounts of firepower, billions of dollars of backing, fighting a country that has about 100 missiles and a couple of rocks. That's the problem that America was kind of having, where it's kind of hard to see them policing the world. Meanwhile, they were beating up black folks and shoving them in ghettos. So in order to look good, Bell believes they went ahead and hurried through these civil rights bills so that now they could go back to fighting their war on foreign land. For this reason, a lot of conservatives, they accused him of being therefore anti-white, which I guess by default makes him pro-black. I don't know. You win some, you lose some, right? Interest convergence actually is the second tenet of critical race theory. The first tenet cuts right through the malarkey, and keeps right on cutting until it gets to the chase. The first tenet claims that America is a racist ass country all day, every day. He's not. Derek Bell is not playing any games with these people. The very first tenet is, y'all racist. The third one asserts that race is merely a social construction. Okay, it's not biological, it's not genetic, it doesn't have its own specific attributes depending on your race. And I don't give a shit what you heard on Sonata TV. Okay, this is Bell's position, and science agrees that it is the society that created race. In this case, the white, our white American society, white Anglo-Saxon Protestant society. And they're the ones that attempted to try to attribute permanent traits where there really are none. And you can actually go all the way back to like 1735 with Carlos Linnaeus and his book, Systema Naturae, all the way through. And you'll see, and Thomas Jefferson is famous for trying to put traits to race and things like that. But really, we're just different shades of human. Which means that if white society can create race, they can manipulate races if they wanted to by inventing new ones, changing names of the races, or they could do us one better and just eliminate race altogether, like they did with Eddie Murphy's career, and conscious rap music, and 90s black sitcoms. So, I'm going to skip over four and go right to five, because I want to be able to say Kimberly Crenshaw, Kimberly Crenshaw, Kimberly Crenshaw. Those two words just sound really amazing together. In addition to having a euphonious name, black feminist and scholar Kimberly Crenshaw coined the term intersectionality in 1989. So what is intersectionality? You've probably already been hearing a lot about it, and maybe it makes no sense to you. Think of it as a socio-political identity bingo game, okay? Except race is not a game. These crackers ain't playing no games out here, all right? Intersectionality is a complex concept, but it kind of has a beautiful symmetry to it if it wasn't for it being stacked with oppression. It basically tracks all the ways a single individual is layered within a society that prioritizes white over color, male over female, straight over gay, cis over trans, this sort of thing. For example, I am a cishet black man. I am a cis heterosexual black man. This indicates that in this society, I likely won't experience gender or sex discrimination. However, I may experience racial discrimination. To demonstrate how schizophrenic this society is, pretend as if white supremacy is like a pre-apocalyptic role-playing game. So if you were creating my character, I would get points for being tall, relatively handsome, brown skin as opposed to dark skin, well-spoken, articulate, and the son of an immigrant. That means that when it comes to like job interviews, if this was a game, I would get the 20-sided dice with a plus 2 modifier. In social situations or amongst white people, you know, or at a job mingle or what do you call it? Like a job happy hour. I don't know. Something like that. In social situations like that, in general, I would tend to fare better than my cishet black male counterparts, comparing apples to apples, because I'm not dark skinned. And though I may be black, since my mother is West Indian, I'm not really black. I know it sounds ridiculous, because it is. Unfortunately, that doesn't stop it from being true. I didn't start this shit. Actually, Benjamin Franklin did. And if you don't believe me, he must have been drunk enough, because he didn't just think about it. He actually wrote it down, and he put it in a letter, and he mailed it. So, if you're a conservative and white, wanna be white, or you're just sort of leaning towards being white, and you're not pissed about critical race theory just yet, wait. Because microaggressions. This was not a Derek Bell discovery, however. The term is actually coined by a psychiatrist from Harvard named Chester Pierce. Before we learned all these highfalutin fancy words for it, we had our own phrase for it. We just called it playing too much. In today's colloquialism of the young people, it has even strengthened and been reinforced into "you got me fucked up," which means you are engaging in brief and commonplace daily verbal, behavioral, or environmental slights, whether intentional or unintentional, that communicate hostile, derogatory, or negative attitudes towards stigmatized or culturally marginalized groups, and you're about to get your ass beat. So don't do those. That's pretty much critical race theory in a nutshell. Please don't go around telling anyone that you are now a critical race theorist because you listen to this podcast. You would at the very least have to read Critical Race Theory by Richard Delgado and Jean Stefanchik. Then you would have to try to get your hands on at least one or two books by Derek Bell. And definitely read Intersectionality by Kimberly Crenshaw. And then you still got to shut the hell up, because you don't know anything until you have at least studied comprehensive and comparative American history, sociology, and economics. And then after about 5 years of study, you may be able to say that you know how to be critical about race. Theoretically. I imagine that you're asking me in your head, Shay, if this is critical race theory, and it's a legal studies framework, only taught in universities and only studied by law students, what the hell are these kooky conservatives crowing about? And you're probably thinking, if it's been around for 50 years, how come I'm only now hearing about it? All right. Well, I have been thinking about this. I mean, I had to prepare for this podcast. So this is something that I had to think about very deeply. I lost many nights of sleep. And I figured it out. Whitey gonna white. I'm sorry. That was obtuse. Okay. How dare I be so obtuse around a sensitive topic like the arbitrary complexion of the human epidermis? Listen, simply put, what is happening? I think social reform. If I give it any thought at all, due to the repressive nature of bigotry in this country, the highly ensconced beliefs around race, sex, gender, and sexuality, the propensity for violence, especially punitive as well as cathartic violence, all of that juxtaposed against convictions and a yearning for freedom and a freedom of expression, albeit written into the Constitution, and I dare say the hearts and minds of all Americans. There will continue to be, I think, every few generation advents of exuberant cultural reform. I mean, I guess you could start with the Revolutionary War, followed by abolition, then the Back to Africa movement. You had Reconstruction. You had the New Negro movement. You had women's suffrage, the Harlem Renaissance, the civil rights movement, feminist movement. You get the idea. These are all people who are struggling with the confines of this country, which, because of the Constitution, does allow for that struggle. They can't resist it too bad. I mean, they did drop a few bodies around it. There's that. Now, in terms of the race issue, consider that it was before the race issue. It was considered the race problem, okay? So here's the race problem. You take a bunch of Africans kicking and screaming from their country and you plop them here and you put them in a plantation. To our credit, we have never stopped kicking and screaming, which I think is America's problem with us. If you notice, oftentimes they'll often ask, well, when is it going to be enough? And I think that's actually a question for you, because it's like, when are you going to stop fucking with us, right? Because we fought to prove that we're not objects or beasts to be bought and sold, but people. And we had to shout until we couldn't possibly ignore it. And then after this fact, they had to integrate our humanity. Then it was like, okay, they're humans along with us. But then it was like, okay, but they're not citizens. Now, even though the law provided for our citizenry, that law was completely ignored. Then we had to fight to prove that we had ideas, like we had ingenuity, that we had a voice, that we had something to say. Because really, if we're not going to go back to Africa, sitting under a baobab tree, barefoot, eating mangoes, then we're going to have to say we're Americans too, right? All right. They could no longer ignore our contributions. So then, yes, finally, after quite a bit of bloodshed, they had to recognize and integrate our citizenry. We have our humanity and our citizenry held in place. We had to make amendments to the Constitution to do this. The Constitution in and of itself didn't provide that for us. Now we have to depend on justice and the justice system to hold these things in place. And if we aren't vigilant, which is what Derrick Bell is trying to say, our station could slip right past those sharp white teeth and back into the bowels of tyranny, tyranny, tyranny. Okay, like black schools, black churches, and black neighborhoods all has something in common with black history. They remain separate and unequal from the rest of America. Here we are right now in this time, kicking and screaming again to have our voice heard and our histories told as we experience them, not as they tell it to us or tell it for us. We want to tell our own story from our point of view. Right now, our acceptance into the whole of America is currently being opposed. They're fighting against the race mixing, the integration of our American story. Therefore, I say, as a united America, we lift our voices and say, move, bitch, get out the way. In public schools, what you're thinking is postmodernistic Marxist theology is actually the rollout of DEI programs, not critical race theory. DEI is just as cool as it sounds. It stands for diversity, equity, and inclusion. Now, depending on where you are, where you live, they may have different acronyms, but those acronyms all will break down to describing the same thing, and they all serve the same function, which I think is self-explanatory. So, unlike the gripes about Black Lives Matter and the funding the police being too confusing in its branding, this one hit the branding spot on. It's totally meta. You don't even have to be fully sober, much less woke, to get it. It's a program, and it's designed to infuse healthy respect for diversity, ensure that everyone is being treated with equity, feels safe, is safe, and included. Bam. So I don't want you to get the wrong idea. Yes, these programs are geared towards minorities since they are statistically subjected to race, gender bias, and adversely affected by race and gender disparities. However, it does not exclude white people or anyone, because unity And equality helps everybody. What does DEI actually do? That's the question you're probably asking. Don't assume. Listen to what I'm going to say. What would be the day in the life, say, of a DEI coordinator, which is what you would need if you have DEI? They sit in front of a computer or some smart device, a cell phone, reading angry emails from parents who believe that they are actually spies for the Chinese government, sent to indoctrinate their children into the wise ways of developing socialist programs and masterminding the creation of widespread famine. But once they're done with that, they go out and actually talk to students, talk to teachers and staff. They make sure that any and all reports of racist language and behavior are being addressed adequately. They make sure that students who may be struggling with reading, math proficiencies are getting extra help. They verify the unrepresented students are also learning about the meaningful contributions of their people. For example, replacing the plays of Shakespeare with the prose of James Baldwin. Expounding on the spectacular event of, say, the Great Migration, which chronicles the generation-long movement of Black Americans from the iron sky and burning furnace of the rural South to the reaching, spreading, beckoning big cities of the North. Now, that one I did stay up all night writing. Learning about the Confederacy of Nations formed by indigenous people, which was actually the blueprint, if you will, for our own republic. Good. Also, you would learn, for example, about the Louisiana Purchase. How the Louisiana Purchase was actually made possible by the first and only successful slave revolt and the creation of the first free nation in the West, La Union. Now, a DEI coordinator also makes sure that the teaching staff reflects the student body. That's where the diversity comes in, and you could add inclusion to that part as well as within the student body. Now, after all that is incomplete, her job still may not be done because now she has to go answer calls from pissed off parents, engorged with OANN news, tired ass Tucker Carlson quips and Jordan Peterson jargon, doling out death threats, threats to end their job. As if they get paid enough for this shit anyway. They don't. The most important part of any activism that you just wouldn't know unless you've done it. They do spend a good portion of their time sitting on the toilet. Wondering, where in the Fraggle Rock were all these concerned parents and interested parties when they needed input on how to help failing students while navigating a crammed curriculum and jammed classrooms? How to handle the teacher who thought they were only helping when they suggested that little Aranisha would look prettier with a perm? Or the white English teacher who thought it was better to stay true to the author's intention rather than guard the psychological well-being of his only two Black students in his predominantly white class by repeating the word nigger over and over again because To Kill a Mockingbird gave him leeway? Where was their outrage and their flair for making Parents for the Purity of Education t-shirts when the only literature in a school full of Black and Latinx students is The Diary of Anne Frank, Huckleberry Finn, and Young Goodman Brown? Where were they when the only thing that passed for diversity in a mostly white school is an all-Black custodial staff? Where were they when the only version of inclusion consisted of construction paper cutouts of feathered engines taped to the classroom wall the week of Thanksgiving, or Martin Luther King quotes that get to hang up there all 4 weeks of Black History Month? This is what they have to deal with. On top of wondering if the school board is ever really going to shut them down because of stupid ass questions like, how long does diversity and equitably and equitable inclusion take, actually? Shouldn't it only take just a few weeks to get everybody on the same page here? No, it took about 250 years for you guys to get so not sure how long it will take. And all they care about is, will it interfere with the state tests? No, it will not interfere with your state tests. In fact, it will probably make them better. Luckily, the DEI coordinator is typically supported by a team because there's no way that she could sit there and delete all those emails on her own. The type of person that usually fills the role of a support team for the DEI coordinator or DEI coordinator is usually like an educator, an activist, some kind of psychologist, maybe a social worker. But these people, you know, don't be alarmed if they have locks, if they wear like colorful head wraps that always match their outfit. They might smell like coconut oil and they might believe in the healing power of crystals. But that's nothing to worry about unless you're a Virgo who worries about everything. Okay, so if that doesn't include you, like you're not a Virgo or on cusp of Virgo and you don't have a Virgo moon, and you're sure that your Mercury is not in the sixth house, because that's a problem. But if you're still worried, I recommend an ionic foot detox because it removes heavy metals and those tend to block the pineal gland. Now, if none of that works and you're still racked with anxiety over inclusion, use your words, man. Talk to your kids, but actually listen. Meet the DI team. Some of them may look alien. Some of them may claim to communicate with aliens, but I can assure you they are good people and they're very good at what they do. They're passionate about what they do. They really engage with the kids and the kids engage with them. I know because this is the work that I do. I've never called it DI or DEI, but that's always the theme that I've worked from. And all the people within my circle, which consists of about a good 30 people. One thing I can tell you about DI programs is that they are community centered. In fact, it is the engine of DEI. They crave parental presence, participation, and input. My only teeny tiny bit of advice is when you approach the space, because that's how they, this is the kind of lingo they use, like you come into the space, you know, they want you to be aware. They want you to be confident. They want you to take deep, even breaths and don't be an asshole because you'll get smudged. Just saying. There you go. DEI and CRT, or diversity, equity, and inclusion, and critical race theory. See, they, if you can see, they kind of inform each other, but like a bad long distance relationship, they never really meet in the same place. One happens in the school. The other only happens in university. Okay, so if anyone walks into your eighth grade math class and utters these 10 words, "I'm a critical race theorist and I'm here to help," you have my permission to politely show them the door and point them in the direction of the nearest community college. However, if they show up as DEI instructors, they may call themselves guides, roll out the red carpet, offer them alkaline water and organic snacks. They are here to help. If you're looking to start a DEI program, DEI, because the terms are interchangeable. Some people just say diversity and inclusion, and then they sometimes just throw equity in there. But if you're looking to start one in your school or maybe in your entire district, you want them on board. I've typically seen these programs begin with parents and or teachers firstly talking to the students, getting feedback from the students on what their respective needs and experiences are. From there, you can get more parents involved, and with enough support, you should be able to approach your school board with a plan and go from there. Now, if you already have a DEI program running in your school or your district, and you're just not sure what to do with all these noxious concerned parties who are just convinced that what you're actually doing, it's just hiding all this stuff behind flowery language, but you're just biding your time, waiting for the opportune moment when your Marxist handler utters the trigger phrase that activates your subconscious programming to begin teaching critical race theory. All you really need to do is just make sure you keep in regular contact with your school board. Keep them abreast of all your activities and progress. I would write it down if I were you. Keep a notebook or something like that. Keep notes. Get testimonials and meet with your school board frequently, once a week, once every 2 weeks. Make sure that you encourage involved parents and teachers and students to show up, to be vocal about their desire and their need for the program. And there you have it, critical race theory. Fun for the whole disruption of the nuclear family. To recap, if you think a university subject taught to law students is being taught at your grammar school to indoctrinate toddlers in postmodernism by teachers who really ain't got time for that shit because common planning meetings are long enough already as it is, you are the one that's being indoctrinated. If you think that's not the case because you're not addicted to Sean Hannity clips and you're able to quit whenever you want, and doing Jordan Peterson impressions in the bathroom mirror is not compulsive, then seriously think about that detox. If you think the Diversity, Equity, and Inclusion Program is not there to teach African and Native American history as an addendum to American history, but instead are plotting a Marxist coup to take over your middle school, check your temperature, because you might be brain dead. Critical race theory is not being taught in your public school. What you are actually witnessing is diversity, equity, and inclusion, a program that implements, promotes, and fosters community, love, prosperity, integrity, and healing. So stop tripping. Talk to the people. Get involved is all it takes before you just try to shut it down. Those are for the people who are on the fence and really just want to know. Now, there's always going to be people who really don't care, and they do have an agenda to keep these things out of their school. Maybe they are actually afraid of having the horrible aspects of America history being told, but it is necessary for the minorities who have borne the brunt of it, for people to kind of understand what they have gone through and what their people have gone through just as recently as my father ago. These things are imperative because they will inform the current situation in America. To what degree, I guess we can discuss at a later date, but at least to some degree, and that's important. I hope it was helpful. If you have any questions at all, you can email me, you can hit me up on Twitter, you can hit me up on Instagram. There is also the Facebook page. And if you want to support me, you can find us on Patreon as well as Anchor. Both places will allow you to donate. That is Being Black on Earth for both the Patreon page and the Anchor page, as well as the websites, www.beingblackonearth.com, in addition to the Facebook page, Being Black on Earth. The Instagram is... it's Being Black on Earth. And the Twitter is Black on Earth. My email, if you want to email me, it's blackbeing@inorbit.com. And that is another episode of the bag. We're all we've got. We're all we've ever had. Look out for me, and I will be looking out for you.